We'll hear argument now in the case of Torber against Germany. Mr. Abbas.
Yes, may it please the court. The undisputed proposition at issue in this case is that a treaty may not infringe upon an individual's constitutional rights. The validation mandate that is in this case is unconstitutional. Now, before I address myself...
Mr. Abbas, did you ask the district court to certify to the Attorney General that the constitutionality of a treaty has been drawn into question?
Well, I did. When Judge Zagel was on the case, I mentioned in one of the documents that there was a constitutional problem with the treaty, yes.
That's not the question I asked. Did you ask the district court to certify to the Attorney General of the United States that the constitutionality of a treaty...
To the Attorney General, no, I did not.
28 U.S.C. 2403A requires certification of constitutional issues so that the Attorney General can intervene to defend the constitutionality of federal statutes, treaties, and so on. And that hasn't been done. I wonder whether that affects the authority to reach a constitutional decision in this case.
Well, Your Honor, I think we'll be aided in the resolution of that problem and the fact that the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. The courts must uphold the Constitution.
I don't see what that has to do with Section 2403A. There are certain procedural steps one has to go through before you can go around declaring statutes and treaties unconstitutional. That's one of those steps.
Okay.
The United States, as an entity, is entitled to notice that somebody is attacking the constitutionality of its enactment. And apparently notice has never been given.
Well, the reason for that, Your Honor, is because we did not file suit against the United States, but I understand the
That's
point that notice...
That's why that statute exists. That statute requires notice to the Attorney General
Yes.
in litigation that otherwise does not involve the United States. That's why it's there.
Okay. Well, I understand the point, Your Honor. If I may proceed...
Go ahead, but okay. I've got one other major question.
Yes.
The burden of your argument seems to be that the United States lacks the authority to settle foreign claims, that is, claims of U.S. citizens against foreign governments. The Supreme Court of the United States held otherwise in the case of Dames and Moore against Reagan. And I must say I am more than a little puzzled that your brief doesn't discuss Dames and Moore, and the appellees don't discuss Dames and Moore. Although, so far as I can see, Dames and Moore is dispositive of these issues. Now, is there some reason why Dames and Moore isn't conclusive against your position?
Well, Your Honor, in applying the case of Reed versus Covert...
No, I asked you about Dames and Moore. Could you discuss Dames and Moore against Reagan?
Well, I did not discuss that case, Your Honor.
I'm well aware of that. But this is your opportunity. This is your one and only opportunity.
Well, Your Honor, quite honestly, I was not, ready to answer that question because I was not. I did not mention that case. I did not research that case, actually, to be honest. So I cannot answer that question at this moment.
Dames and Moore upheld against constitutional challenge the validity of the Iranian asset settlement. And the Supreme Court said along the way that the United States government possesses, through treaties and executive agreement, the power to settle U.S. claims against foreign governments, and held that there can be no takings clause objection to that settlement. Justice Powell dissented from that holding but it was otherwise an 8-1 decision of the Supreme Court. And
okay.
We are bound by decisions of the Supreme Court, and okay. It seems to me Dames and Moore is conclusive
on
these issues.
Okay, Your Honor, if I may. As I understand, it's U.S. claims versus the Iranian government is the
claims
premise.
Of U.S. nationals.
Okay. The first answer to that is Elfriede Korber is not a U.S. national, so that would not apply to her.
So how does she have a takings claim?
She has a takings claim.
How does she have protection of the Constitution as a non-citizen? I understand how non-citizens have access to the courts and so forth and some constitutional protections, but how can she suffer a takings or other due process?
Well, we have the international the claim for takings of international law claiming takings of rights and property. You know,
let me put it somewhat differently. How could it be conceivable that a U.S. citizen would have no claim under the takings clause, but an alien would have a claim under the takings clause? That would be topsy-turvy.
Well, Your Honor, and the Alien Tort Statute. Statute which exists, it says that a alien may bring a claim for violations of treaties and torts and violations of treaties. So
your plaintiff isn't bringing a claim for a violation of treaties. Your plaintiff is attacking the treaty.
Well, there is a violation of treaty, of course, Your Honor. We said in our claim that this treaty that we are at issue with, number one. Is supposed to establish a validation board in the United States. That validation board has ceased to exist, so that fundamental aspect of that treaty has been breached. Where can you go to validate in the United States if you have no validation board? That's the first problem we have with that treaty. The second, under Reed versus Covert, it said that no agreement can be made. You can't make a valid treaty, in other words. You can't make a valid treaty that conflicts with the Constitution or with the Bill of Rights.
That's perfectly straightforward. And Dames and Moore held that a treaty that resolves property claims with respect to enemies of the United States is valid under the Takings Clause and the Treaty Clause.
Okay, well, that's with respect to enemies of the United States.
Germany, as I recall, was an enemy of the United States. We declared war on Germany, we made peace with Germany, and we settled property claims with Germany. As I say, this case is, under Dames against Moore, dead on arrival, and I just don't see how it is possible for both sides to have ignored it.
Well, I think I would like to proceed with talking about the bearer bonds now, because if I can move to the question of the bearer bonds, because the bearer bonds themselves say that no treaty, that they must be paid irrespective of any treaty or rule or regulation. If we look at just at the four corners of the bond, no one...
So you think a private party can surrender the treaty power of the President and Congress?
No, I think this statute...
No, indeed not.
No, what I'm saying, Your Honor... is that this statute that says that if the government resolves a claim with a foreign nation, that an individual loses his rights to make a claim, we would take the position that that statute cannot be held valid with respect to individual rights, because the Constitution,
you are making the very argument that Dames and Moore made in the Dames and Moore case. It was, perhaps, as of 1981, a respectable argument. But the Supreme Court of the United States rejected it, and we don't have any authority to overrule them.
Okay, understood. So now let's talk about then the treaties and how they should be interpreted and the bonds in this case. If we are going to accept this treaty as valid, then we have the London Debt Accord, which specifically obligates Germany to pay these debts. So Germany agreed to settle these bonds. And Germany agreed that the primary objective of the treaty, of the London Debt Accord, was to eliminate the state of default. That was the primary purpose. And to pay these pecuniary obligations. And the bondholders had a choice under Article 15 of that treaty, either to accept it or to reject it. They could not be forced to accept a settlement offer with Germany if they did not want to accept it. It was their, they had the freedom of choice. So under that treaty and under the validation treaty, the Certain Matters Treaty, which compels individuals to validation, and I will discuss that in a minute, but under that treaty, you had the choice, and even the Belgian delegates, if we look at what the treaty negotiators said and what Herman Apps, who was the chief German negotiator of this treaty, what he said was, this was a framework agreement. That means the bondholder had the right to keep his pre-existing rights. But the only thing they said is that if you don't accept the treaty, you just have to wait in line. And this, I think, there's unanimity. All of the attorneys and the brief from Germany, everyone agrees on this one point. I think it's difficult to get 10 lawyers to agree on anything, but everybody agrees on this one point, that the bondholders who did not accept the London Debt Accord, they had to wait in line until everybody else who accepted those pennies on the dollar, those settlement, the wanted something for nothing, those people got paid first. Now, the final payment, as Germany agreed, was on October 3rd, 2010. So the bondholders could not, the earliest that they could obtain relief, the earliest that they could get their money back, those who didn't accept the treaty, was after October 3rd, 2010, which comes back to the statute of limitations and the ripeness issue. We look at the ripeness issues at the present moment under the Regional Rail Act. So the claims are ripe for adjudication, and the bonds are very explicit, and the bonds are the kind of bonds that most investors would dream of, because they have everything included in them to attract an investor. They're payable, the Germany promised payment in gold, Germany promised payment to the bearer, whoever is holding it. So it's irrelevant, it's academic whether a bond was stolen or not stolen, or that whole story, by the way, has melted into thin air. They've admitted that bonds were never stolen. When they reunified, they got those bonds back. And with respect to a bearer bond under the Uniform Commercial Code, which is respected worldwide, whoever's holding the bond has the right to make a claim. Otherwise, you've abolished the ownership of bonds. What's the point of being an owner of a bearer bond if you come to make a claim and they tell you, yes, you have a beautiful bond, but you can only hang it up on the wall like decoration paper. You can't even make a claim with your bond. That makes no sense. So under these, and the bonds say they are unconditional guarantees. And if we look at the plain language of the bond, unconditional means no conditions, means Germany cannot make excuses for non-payment.
Now these bonds, is it your position they were validated?
Well, my position is we've called into, because we submitted the bonds, or Ilfried Korber submitted these bonds to the examining agency, Commerzbank in Dusseldorf. And the bonds were sitting there for a year and a half. So she complied with the process, even though as a Belgian, there was no bilateral treaty, or the LDA never obligated her to go. But she followed along with what they said. She submitted her bonds, and they refused her validation. Mm-hmm. Under the Avery versus Roche case.
Right, and so that's a problem, too, because if we accept your argument that that your claims have not accrued because you've not validated your bonds, wouldn't we have to dismiss your claims anyway? In other words, why should we rule on causes of action that haven't even accrued yet?
No, we're saying that the cause of action under the Bay Area Laundry versus Furbar case, under that rule of accrual, it says that a cause of action is complete and present when you have, one, the right to file suit, and second, you have the right to obtain relief and payment. So even if we had filed suit earlier, you could not obtain your relief or payment until 2010. So the actual time that the bonds, that the cause of action accrued is 2010. So all the claims are timely. We filed in 2009 the second amended complaint. And in terms of ripeness, under the Regional Rail Act, it doesn't matter at the time of dismissal or at the time the appeal was filed or in the past. What's important is the claim ripe at the present moment? And we say that the claim is, of course, ripe for adjudication, and the bonds are 100% valid. They're perfectly lawful, and therefore they should be respected. And under international law, a sovereign debt must be paid. We have the case from Germany herself, where a German bondholder sued Argentina for non-payment of the bonds. And under international law, and I think this is an important point, because in the Paquet Habana, Justice Gray said international law is part of our law, but nobody is applying international law, nobody's administering international law, which is supposed to be administered here, and under the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, it says that an agreement, a treaty is defined as an agreement between two nations in written form, which is governed by international law. So that's the rule of decision we have to use here. There's no excuse and no justification for a sovereign nation, after defaulting intentionally, taking people's money, waging war with people's money, and then thereafter signing an agreement saying, yes, we're liable, so there's no question about liability, and the bonds themselves say there's no question about liability. It's an open and shut case with respect to liability. They know they're responsible, but then they say, well, the reason why we haven't paid is because Eisenhower signed this treaty. Well, under international law, and because we passed an internal law in Germany called the Validation Law, under the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, you can pass whatever internally whatever law you want, but that doesn't release you of obligations to pay the bondholders. These are investors who put their life savings in these bonds. Some of them maybe pledged their lives and shed blood in the Second World War, and now we're saying that these bondholders, that none of them have any remedies or any claims. It's not possible like this. So with respect to the other claim of unjust enrichment, it's a very simple claim. Germany took people's money and they have to pay it back. This is a very simple claim. They say, well, we didn't use the word received from issuer, but we said they held it in trust and it's identifiable and it's available. And Germany now can pay. They have the ability. They're bailing out countries like Greece. They want to give lessons in debt management and debt repayment to Greece, but they're not paying their own debts. I mean, how isn't the four corners rule or the sanctity of contract doesn't that have any meaning anymore when a country engages in a contract with a private individual? Now, if Eisenhower, with all due respect to him, if he wanted to forgive government to government debt, that's fine, that's his prerogative, he has discretion. But when he's talking about private individuals, if I want to forgive Germany her debt and say to Germany, okay, I'll only take 50%, I'll only take 10%, that's up to me as a private individual. It's not up to the President or Congress to say, we're going to change your...
Unfortunately for you, the Supreme Court held otherwise in Dames and Moore as part of the dispute to the settlement of the Iranian claims. As I say, you're making the very arguments that Dames and Moore made.
Okay.
32 years ago, they were live arguments. After the Supreme Court decided Dames and Moore, I don't see how they're live arguments.
Okay, well, then let me return to the validation treaty. They come and say, well, you know, you have to go to Germany to validate your bonds because there's no longer any validation here. There's no validation in the United States anymore. So that part of the treaty is breached. You have a material breach of a treaty. So if there's a material breach, you cannot enforce the treaty anymore because the basic institution that was in the United States to hear these claims is no longer available. And in Germany, from the experience of Ilfried Korber, there is no such thing as the due process that you have here in the United States. For example, you know, in the United States, whenever you want to prove damages, you can bring your expert. You bring your economic expert or financial expert, and they do their expertise, they do their valuation, you present it in open court. There's no such thing over there. They've already predetermined what the price is on the bonds, and you can't argue with that. They will, if they decide to pay you, if they decide to validate, and they have no reasonable basis to make a judicial decision over there, because how does a person in Germany decide when they're looking at a bond, not that it matters, whether this bond was stolen in 1945 or not, or show me where your location was. If they're looking at the bond, how do they make that decision? They say, well, we have a secret, or we have this list of bonds, so we know which ones are stolen or not stolen. But if you ask them, or if I ask them, please show it to the court, or show it to me, show me the list to see if our bonds are on that list. Or they'll tell you, no, this is a secret. They should not even call this the settlement chamber. They should call it the Star Chamber, like in medieval times, because that's how it operates, in secrecy and behind closed doors. And you have no open hearing. We know that due process, at the minimum, you have to have an open hearing. There is no hearing over there. So the entire process violates the entire procedures. And we have called into question the competency and the procedures over there, these are factual allegations. We have to have our day in court, at minimum, before dismissing the case and saying, no, it's not possible that that this process is incompetent or not. But we went through that process, and we know that it's not viable in the sense of constitutional viability and the due process protections and the safeguards. So if you thrust individuals, and it comes to the application of the treaty or the interpretation of the treaty, if you're going to interpret it that everybody has to schlep over to Germany, you're depriving them of their right to jury. There's no right to jury in Germany, and there's no right to a fair hearing that you have in the in the United States. So I think I've covered most of the issues that I wanted to cover.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. May it please the court.
Mr. Harris.
Yes. First, I'd like to address a question Judge Williams raised. The validation. The 1953 treaty didn't settle any claims. What it did is it required that bonds be validated before a claimant could try and enforce those bonds in U.S. courts. Ms. Korber, to the extent that she attempted to validate, and it's hard to tell from the allegation if that's the in the complaint, but giving the plaintiff their due, assuming she attempted to validate and was turned down, her appeal from that decision has to be filed within 90 days, or the decision to turn down her request for validation becomes final. So she has finally unvalidated bonds in that she failed, if she thought she had been turned down from validation, she failed to appeal to the Chamber for Settlements, and then there was a further appeal to the intermediate German appellate court. None of that was done. Her validation claim is and was a long time ago final. With respect to the general proposition about validation, there were two treaties here, what's known as the London Debt Accord, and that did attempt to settle claims against foreign governments and other parties. However, as Mr. Abbas says, and his clients did, they failed to accept. They had the option to accept or reject being a part of the settlement in the London Debt Accord. And they claim that they rejected the chance to participate in the London Debt Accord. Hence, that treaty has absolutely no application to them. The only treaty that has any application to Mr. Abbas's clients is the 1953 treaty, which simply says that before you cannot have access to the U.S. courts to enforce a bond until you have first validated it. Now, at the time that was passed, the validation law, which is incorporated by reference into that treaty, had a 5-year period in which to validate your bonds. And that was from 1953 to 1958. During that period of time, the United States had a validation board which sat in New York and which handled thousands of claims for validation. When that 5-year statutory period expired, the U.S. Validation Board filed its final report and went out of business. However, the validation law itself provided extraordinary relief, saying that you can validate even after the 5-year period, and that period in which you can validate after the 5-year period is over is without limit. It's almost an unprecedented statute. If you can show that the reason you failed to validate during the applicable 5-year period was not due to your own gross negligence, and that the bonds would have been validated upon timely application. So if you haven't validated your bonds and you can show that it was not through your own gross negligence, you can still validate. But the place that you need to go, the equivalent of the U.S. Validation Board, is called an examining agency in Germany. And those examining agencies still operate. And anyone who has unvalidated bonds and can satisfy the requirement as to why they're validating late still has that opportunity to do so. In this case, there has been, according to Mr. Abbas's statements, there has been no attempt to validate. So the consequence is not that Mr. Abbas's clients have bonds that cannot be paid, but he cannot access U.S. courts for enforcement of those bonds unless and until they're validated. Now, the reason that this requirement was put in is because the Russian army got to Berlin first, and they went into the Reichsbank in Berlin, and according to the Eisenhower administration, they stole lots and lots of bonds. The SEC, which had during World War, leading up to and during World War II, refused to allow trading in German bond issues during the war, which is understandable, at the end of the war said, because of the actions of the Russians, we will not allow these bonds to be traded in U.S. markets, even though they're payable in the United States, because we think the integrity of the bonds is in question because the Russians stole so many of them that were stored in the Reichsbank. That is the genesis of the validation law, the 1953 treaty, which requires validation before access to the U.S. courts. That rationale was legitimate. It had it was reasonably related to the problem that had come up, and as we cite in our brief, putting that requirement as a bar to enforcement in U.S. courts, even though there was no such requirement when the bonds were first sold, which was in the period 1924 to 1930, it was reasonably related to a legitimate governmental interest, namely the integrity of the securities markets in the United States. That's the genesis of the 1953 treaty. With regard to the interpretation of that treaty, this is the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals to address that issue. The Second Circuit, the First Circuit, and the 11th Circuit have all had precisely the claim, the same claim that is being made here today. That namely, I don't have to first validate my bonds to have them enforced in U.S. courts, because that validation requirement only applies to people who accepted the terms of the London Debt Accord. Now, just to give you 30 seconds on the London Debt Accord, what it did is it said if you have an original bond, and if you you can turn it in and get a conversion bond, and in return for your doing that, we will pay you a higher rate of interest on those bonds, and there were certain other benefits that went along with it. One of the common factors in this case, as in the other circuits, none of the litigants in those cases accepted the terms of the London Debt Accord. They wanted to enforce their original bonds, which, if they didn't accept the London Debt Accord, they could do. They make much of the argument that they were prohibited from seeking enforcement of those bonds, and hence their until all payments had been made under the London Debt Accord. They had to wait in line until everyone who accepted the offer contained in the London Debt Accord had been paid. That is categorically not true. What the London Debt Accord said in Section 10 was that if you don't accept the terms of the London Debt Accord, you have to wait in line to be paid unless your obligation is a marketable security from a creditor country. The United States was a creditor country, and these bonds were marketable securities. So there was an exception in the London Debt Accord that if you were in this category, the holder of a bond like Mr. Abbas's clients claim to be, that you do not have to wait, and you did not have to wait because Section 10 of the London Debt Accord had a specific exclusion for the very bonds that are at issue in our case today. And the 11th Circuit had the same argument presented to them that is presented here, namely that you have to wait to get paid if you don't accept the terms of the London Debt Accord. They, in their opinion, you will see, they looked at Section 10 of the London Debt Accord and highlighted that exclusion, the very last sentence of Section 10, which says that, as I stated, that the waiting in line does not apply to marketable securities of a creditor country. So these claims could have been brought when the bond matured. That's generally when you can sue to enforce a bond. And that was not done in this case. And there are only two reasons that one could argue that the statute of limitations is still alive and well. One is that under the London Debt Accord, I had to wait in line to be paid, and Mr. Abbas's reply brief says the London Debt Accord payments were finalized in October of 2010. Previously, he had a different date. However, as I just said, the argument that what's fatal to his argument is the fact that under the London Debt Accord, of course, the waiting for payment is these bonds are excluded from that section where you have to wait for payment. Hence, the claims of Mr. Abbas's clients are clearly barred by the statute of limitations. The only other argument that can be made on the statute of limitations is that because you can validate your bonds after the fact, after the statute expires, if you can satisfy this gross negligence standard, that fails as well for two reasons. One, Mr. Abbas makes no claims in his first or second amended complaint as to exactly why these claims weren't brought, why he can satisfy the gross negligence standard. And second, even if he could make such a claim, which he did not, the place that you need to go to validate your bonds after this five-year statutory period is Germany. And Mr. Abbas would have to go to Germany, make his claim, and the validation law specifically says that and the Second Circuit points this out in the Mortimer decision, that the exclusive jurisdiction for such determinations lie with the German courts. So, either way, in addition to his failure to validate, which is fatal to his claims, and the causes of action were properly dismissed, even if that were not an insurmountable argument, the statute of limitations on his claims have expired a long time ago. We also make arguments in our brief dealing with whether he has adequately pleaded under Rule 9 with specificity, since the entire complaint has sounds of fraudulent averments. The theme of the complaint is that all these defendants somehow conspired and committed fraudulent acts to avoid paying the bonds. When Mr. Abbas asked Judge Zagel to file a second amended complaint, Judge Zagel's parting words to his co-counsel, Mr. Terrazio, who's here today, were, you know, do not come back with another complaint that talks about what the, quote, defendants did. If you're alleging fraud, you need to tell me the who, what, when, where, and how of each particular defendant. The second amended complaint, Mr. Abbas added volume to it, and it ballooned to some 250 pages. But the same sort of failings that Judge Zagel pointed out to Mr. Abbas are present in this complaint. It talks about fraudulent acts, conspiracies, the defendants committed. It doesn't identify who these particular defendants are. It puts no insufficient meat on the bones to meet the statutory standards of Section 9 of the rules. In addition, even under this court's jurisprudence and the Supreme Court's jurisprudence, Bell Atlantic and the Iqbal case, these are speculative, so speculative as to be below the standard of pleading that we now know, since those cases and its progeny are the standard for pleading. So in addition to the fact that the failure to validate is fatal to his case, the statute of limitations has run, and the pleading was insufficient. These are all the things that Judge Chang addressed in his opinion, in his well-reasoned opinion, and we would ask this court to affirm his judgment. If there are no further questions, I'll relinquish the rest of my time.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.